The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the September 15th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The drawing on the cover this week has a smiling North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, looking over a chessboard. And the chess pieces are, let's see, they're soldiers and some of them are missiles. And then he's got his hand on one that looks like a nuclear mushroom cloud. And he's smiling and making a move. And the title says, Kim's Big Move. Why is North Korea escalating its nuclear threat to destroy U.S. cities? And I believe that is the first of the main stories. Kim raises the nuclear stakes again. What happened? North Korea sparked condemnation and consternation throughout the world this week after detonating a massive nuclear device that it claimed was a hydrogen bomb capable of hitting the U.S. mainland. The Hermit Kingdom's sixth nuclear test, the first since President Donald Trump took office, was measured as a magnitude 6.3 earthquake. Nuclear scientists estimated its yield at 100 kilotons, up to 10 times more powerful than North Korea's last detonation, and about 5 times the size of the bomb that destroyed Nagasaki in 1945. Hours before the launch, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un posed with what he said was a hydrogen bomb that could be mounted on an intercontinental ballistic missile. Pyongyang described the underground explosion as a perfect success. After meeting with President Trump, Secretary of Defense James Mattis warned that any threat from North Korea to use a nuclear weapon against the U.S. would be met with a massive military response. Trump initially criticized Seoul for the appeasement of its neighbor, but later agreed to lift restrictions preventing the country from developing more powerful missiles. He also said he was considering stopping all trade with any country doing business with North Korea, which would include China. At an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley said Kim was begging for war and called for sanctions that would cut off North Korea's oil supply. But Russia and China pushed for talks with the rogue nation instead and argued that Pyongyang will stand down only if it receives assurances of the regime's security. Russian President Vladimir Putin warned that threatening the North Koreans with annihilation could lead to nuclear catastrophe and said the North Koreans would rather eat grass than abandon their nuclear program. What the editorial said. The North Korean nuclear threat is worsening by the day, said the New York Times. Trump's schoolyard threats have failed to intimidate Kim, and U.S. policy has been incoherent. Kim Jong-un understandably sees nuclear weapons as his only guarantee of survival when Libyan leader Muammar al-Qaddafi gave up his nuclear program. He ended up being bombed by the U.S. and its allies, then executed by rebels. Beijing is unlikely to agree to an oil ban because that could cause Kim regime's collapse and put a united pro-Western Korea on China's doorstep. The only remaining option is to engage the North Koreans and see what Kim wants. A military strike has to be a last resort, said the Wall Street Journal. War on the peninsula would decimate Seoul and could leave hundreds of thousands dead. But the U.S. does have other options. Washington can expand efforts to encourage North Korean elites to stage an internal coup. It could impose secondary sanctions on countries or companies that deal with Pyongyang. More drastically, the U.S. could cut off North Korea's food aid in the hope that the resulting chaos would bring down the government. That may seem unethical, but 40% of the Hermit Kingdom's population is already undernourished. Ending the North Korean state as quickly as possible is the most humane course. What the columnist said. All this hysteria over North Korea's nuclear program is overwrought, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. The size or range of an arsenal doesn't affect the central premise of nuclear deterrence. Country X won't fire nukes at Country Y if Country Y has nukes it can fire back. Kim knows full well that launching an attack on the U.S. or its allies would result in an annihilating retaliatory blow, and what's most important to him is self-preservation. So what does Kim want? Said Motoko Rich and David Sanger in the New York Times. Some analysts fear he'll use his nuclear weapons to blackmail the U.S., saying he'll incinerate Los Angeles, Washington, or New York if we don't withdraw our 28,000 troops from South Korea. If our troops left, he could then try to reunify the Korean Peninsula by force, a long-time goal for Pyongyang. Or perhaps the North Korean dictator just wants a nuclear capability too big to dismantle, for his country to be treated like Pakistan and India, which no longer face international pressure to dismantle their arsenals. Washington's only remaining play is to force China to bring its client state to heel, said Tom Rogan in the Washington Examiner. How? By locking out of the global financial system Chinese companies and banks that deal with North Korea. Yes, that would likely spark a costly economic showdown with a major trading partner, but given the stakes, that may be a price worth paying. It's time to roll the dice. However Trump approaches this dilemma, he needs to cut out the bellicose rhetoric, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. In the past few weeks, the president has declared that talking is not the answer and threatened Kim with fire and fury like the world has never seen. What Trump doesn't understand is that wars often start when national leaders play chicken and try to look stronger than their opponents. World War I, the Gulf War, and Iraq were triggered by leaders' miscalculations. Every time Trump matches Kim threat for threat, he increases the chances of a catastrophic conflict neither side wants. And we'll read the second main story today. Houston begins massive Harvey recovery effort. What happened? Tens of thousands of flood victims were returning to their waterlogged home in the Houston area this week to start a massive cleanup effort in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. Now officially the second most destructive storm in U.S. history. At least 70 people were killed when Harvey dumped more than 20 trillion gallons of rain on Texas and Louisiana, destroying up to 40,000 homes in the Houston area alone. As President Trump made his second visit to Texas to comfort victims, concerns grew over the city's floodwaters, which are believed to contain a dangerous mix of sewage and pollutants from flooded oil refineries, chemical plants, and at least 13 nearby Superfund toxic waste sites. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said that damage from Harvey could total up to $180 billion, more than Hurricane Katrina. This is going to be a huge catastrophe that people need to come to grips with, said Abbott. The House overwhelmingly approved an initial $7.9 million Harvey aid package. Trump backed a Democratic proposal to add provisions to the relief measure that would extend government funding and raise the debt ceiling until December in order to avert a fiscal showdown at the end of September. The announcement blindsided GOP leaders who wanted to raise the debt ceiling for 18 months to avoid a divisive political fight ahead of the 2018 midterms. Meanwhile, the Coast Guard moved helicopters from Texas to Puerto Rico and Florida in anticipation of Hurricane Irma, a huge Category 5 storm expected to hit the U.S. over the weekend. As soon as one ends, we need to make sure we are ready for the next event, said Admiral Paul Zukunft, Coast Guard Commandant. What the editorial said: so far, Harvey has not become synonymous with government mismanagement, as Katrina did, said the Washington Post. But some 30,000 people remain displaced from their homes, and officials still face dicey public health threats, such as toxic chemical spills, acrid smoke, and waterborne disease. 500,000 people may eventually need disaster assistance, said the Chicago Tribune. Repairing and rebuilding from a natural catastrophe this immense will take months, will take not months, but years. Let's hope Congress doesn't behave the way it did after Hurricane Katrina and Sandy, said the New Orleans Times-Picayune. It took lawmakers 10 months to approve funding to help rebuild thousands of homes damaged by levee breaks around New Orleans. 7 years later, Senator Ted Cruz and 21 other Texas Republicans refused to back a $50 billion aid package after Sandy devastated the Northeast because the funding wasn't matched by spending cuts. Shame on them. Disaster victims shouldn't be held hostage to a philosophical discussion. What the columnist said: blocking the Sandy bill was the principled thing to do, said Ben Dominick in TheFederalist.com. The measure was chock full of pork that had no relation to disaster relief. That included $1 million for new cars for the Drug Enforcement Agency and $2 million for the Smithsonian's famously leaky roofs. Cruz and company are still hypocrites, said Amber Phillips in The Washington Post. Harvey aid relief will probably have just as much pork in it, yet Texas Republicans intend to vote for it all the same. Apparently, it's easier to stay true to your fiscally conservative principles when the wreckage of a natural disaster is some 1,700 miles away. Lawmakers should aim their fire at the Federal National Flood Insurance Program, said Jeb Henserling in USNews.com. Harvey wouldn't have caused so much damage without the subsidy program, which gives people perverse incentives to build and rebuild homes and businesses in flood-prone areas. In one case, the NFIP paid nearly $1 million to rebuild one $120,000 Houston home that flooded 16 times in 18 years. It's insanity. Harvey has taken all the fire out of September's legislative showdown, said Jim Newell in Slate.com. The natural disaster gives GOP leaders an emergency excuse to blow through must-pass obstacles on the debt ceiling and government funding, postponing those toxic fights until December. And the relief bill allows Trump, who has so enjoyed playing Mr. Hurricane Fixer Man, his first real legislative win. For Republicans, there was never a better time for 51 inches of rain to fall on America's fourth largest city. Our controversy of the week: dreamers, will 800,000 young immigrants be deported? He's really doing it, said Ben Mathis Lilly in Slate.com. After months of indecision, President Trump this week sent out Attorney General Jeff Sessions to announce an end to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, D-A-C-A, that has shielded nearly 800,000 children of illegal immigrants from deportation. Trump had once promised he would show great heart in dealing with these dreamers, as they are called, and told them they could rest easy. Now he's given Congress 6 months to either legalize DACA or kill it, leaving hundreds of thousands of young people who came to the U.S. at an average age of six filled with fear and anxiety. What a callous betrayal, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. The Dreamers came to this country through no fault of their own, and DACA status was granted only to those who attended high school and passed criminal background checks. Fully 97% are either working or still in school, and the conservative Cato Institute estimates that deporting them would reduce U.S. economic growth by $280 billion over the next 10 years. But Trump is threatening to deport them anyway, back to lands they barely know, as a sop to his angry nativist supporters. All Trump has done, said Jonathan Turley in TheHill.com, is return this question to where it should have remained, Congress. President Obama simply had no constitutional authority to grant amnesty to nearly a million illegal immigrants, let alone issue them work permits. Obama himself stressed that DACA was only a temporary stopgap measure. If anything, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post, Trump has taken a giant step toward truly legalizing the Dreamers. Many Republican leaders, including Speaker Paul Ryan, have already signaled their support for legislation protecting the Dreamers, and with Trump's six-month deadline now ticking down, Congress has a new incentive to act quickly. That's nonsense, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. The Republican caucus is filled with anti-immigrant hardliners who erroneously claim Dreamers are taking away jobs from Americans. Does it really seem plausible that Republicans who can't even pass legislation high on their agenda, such as repealing Obamacare, are about to write into law the immigration policy of a president they detested? It does not, said Dara Lind in Vox.com. Congress' agenda is already extremely tight for the next 6 months. And because the Dreamers gave their names and addresses to the government when they applied for their permits, they could easily be deported if no legislation is passed. So let's make a deal, said Harlan Hill and TheHill.com. Congressional Republicans and Trump himself would agree to legislation protecting the Dreamers if Democrats would make concessions on other aspects of immigration policy. They'll have to agree to fund a southern border wall, Trump's most visible and prized project, as well as to impose reasonable limits on legal immigration. No broad deal like that is likely, said Sam Stein in TheDailyBeast.com. Immigration activists and Dreamers themselves are already lobbying Democratic lawmakers to reject any deal that would result in a border wall. Knowing that 70% of Americans support letting DACA recipients stay, prominent Democrats say they will refuse to turn Dreamers into bargaining chips and are demanding a clean bill legalizing DACA as soon as possible. Here comes another partisan Washington power struggle, one with the lives of 800,000 hostages at stake. Time for our good week, bad week short pieces. Let's see what we have. It was a good week for second acts after Sean Spicer, President Trump's hapless first press secretary, announced that he was available to give paid speeches on the lecture circuit and share the same candor, wit, and insight he brought to the White House briefings. It was a good week for Apple after the New York Yankees accused the Boston Red Sox of using an Apple Watch to transmit stolen pitching signs. As Will Ormus in Slate.com observed, the Red Sox may have finally found a good use for the Apple Watch. And it was a good week for Andrew Jackson, who may remain on the $20 bill after all. The Obama administration decided to replace the former president with abolitionist Harriet Tubman, but current Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said, "We've got a lot more important issues to focus on." But it was a bad week for foul mouths after tennis player Fabio Fognini was disqualified from the U.S. Open for delivering a torrent of Italian curses against a female umpire, including calling her a whore. Fognini later apologized, saying he was a hothead having a very bad day. It was a bad week for liquid assets after a New Zealand man reported his car stolen, unaware that he'd actually sold it to a stranger the previous day while drunk for cash to buy more drinks. Sergeant Dennis Murphy says he told the man that the lesson here is don't drink and sell cars. And finally, it was a bad week for cover-ups after a British woman on a first date became trapped in the window of her date's bathroom while trying to dispose of a lump of non-flushing poop. "She's a lovely girl," said her sympathetic date, Liam Smith, after the embarrassed woman had been freed. "Who knows what the future holds?" On the briefing page now, titled this week, "The Great Deregulation." President Trump has embarked on the most aggressive regulatory rollback in history. What's the goal? President Trump declared war on the regulation industry on his first day in office, arguing it was choking economic growth. He immediately signed a two-for-one executive order requiring federal agencies to identify two regulations to eliminate for each new rule they want to impose. And with the help of the Republican-led Congress, he has killed or delayed more than 860 federal rules and regulations affecting almost all faces of everyday life. From environmental regulations banning coal plants from dumping waste into public waterways, to mattress flammability standards and meat and poultry processing guidelines. "There's never been a president, and I'm including President Reagan, who has been harsher and more aggressive," said Rena Steinsor, professor of the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. Which agency is leading the way? The Environmental Protection Agency, headed by former Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. A climate change skeptic, Pruitt sued the EPA 14 times as Attorney General, nearly always in partnership with the oil and gas industry. As EPA head, Pruitt is gutting former President Barack Obama's environmental legacy, moving to rescind the Clean Power Plan and undo limits on greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants, as well as lifting the ban on offshore drilling in the Arctic, Pacific, and Atlantic Oceans. Pruitt is also targeting basic anti-pollution guidelines. He outraged environmentalists and public health scientists by scrapping a rule prohibiting power plants from dumping toxic pollutants, including arsenic, lead, mercury, and cadmium, into public streams, rivers, and lakes. In addition, the EPA has rescinded a proposed ban on the widespread use of the pesticide chlorpyrifos on crops, despite evidence it can damage children's neurological development. What about other agencies? The Interior Department has rolled back a ban on coal mining on public lands and recommended that Trump use an executive order to shrink at least three national monuments in Utah and Oregon to open up hundreds of thousands of acres to mining and drilling. The Labor Department has postponed a rule that would have minimized construction workers' exposure to carcinogenic silica dust, while Betsy DeVos's Education Department wants to eliminate more than a half dozen Obama-era measures designed to protect students from for-profit colleges' predatory loan practices. What about banking? Wall Street will also enjoy the fruits of the Trump administration's anti-regulation fervor. The Treasury Department, headed by former Goldman Sachs executive Steve Mnuchin, has already targeted nearly 90 banking and financial regulations for reassessment or repeal. The changes would lift the gross profit of the six largest U.S. banks by $27 billion. Many of the targeted rules were passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis to rein in the kind of risky banking activities that led to the meltdown. The implementation of the fiduciary rule, which would have required financial advisors to act in the consumer's best interest rather than recommending investments that they're paid to push, has also been delayed by 18 months. The overall effect of this rollback, argues regulatory police advocate Amit Narang, is to leave Americans vulnerable on a daily basis to unsafe products and tainted food, dangerous workplaces, and a newly deregulated Wall Street that once again could threaten economic collapse. What is Trump's rationale? He believes deregulation is key to achieving his campaign promise of providing at least 3% annual economic growth. Trump and other Republicans argue the number of government regulations grew out of control under Obama. The printed version of the Federal Register, which records government regulations, hit 97,110 pages under Obama's watch, surpassing the previous record of 81,405. And the conservative think tank American Action Forum estimated that Obama-era regulations imposed a cumulative burden of $890 billion on businesses. It's not as if there aren't an enormous number of regulations still on the books, said Mark Short, Trump's legislative affairs director. I think it would be unfair to paint it as if you are moving into an anarchical society. What do businesses think of deregulation? They love it. The Dow and S&P 500 are up more than 8% so far in 2017, while 80% of the members of the National Association of Manufacturers say they support Trump's deregulation campaign. Many constituents in states where oil and gas drilling are being freed from environmental rules are also happy, believing that deregulation will lead to more jobs and higher wages. But Politico.com recently reported that many oil and gas industry officials worry about the aggressive pace and reach of Trump's regulatory rollback. If there's an environmental catastrophe, like a major oil spill or water supply poisoning, said Brian Youngberg, an energy analyst at the investment firm Edward Jones, it would create a powerful backlash against deregulation and the energy industry. You don't need to roll things back so far that it opens an opportunity for outsiders to criticize, or something bad happens, Youngberg said. Move into the best columns of the week now. We'll start with one from the U.S. This one is titled, In Praise of Cultural Appropriation. The increasingly strident left has some strange notions, said Barry Weiss. But perhaps the silliest is its obsession with stamping out cultural appropriation. In Portland, Oregon, activists have created a blacklist of white-owned appropriative restaurants to boycott because Caucasians shouldn't make tacos or dosas. The University of Michigan is hiring bias response worker to enact cultural appropriation prevention initiatives. Is there a more un-American idea than this? Our mongrel culture is so wondrously complex because it blends food, music, art, languages, clothing, and sensibilities from all over the world. This is not stealing, but syncretism, creating something new by mixing old ideas in revelatory ways. Ours is a nation where the Russian-born Jewish immigrant Irving Berlin wrote White Christmas, where black Southerner Jesse Norman became one of the greatest opera singers of all time, where even our national symbol, Lady Liberty, was made in France. Yet the dour enforcers of the cultural appropriation ban would have us remain in the ethnic and racial lanes assigned to us by accident of our birth. No, thank you. Culture should be shared, not hoarded. This comes from France. Mental illness doesn't cause terrorism. The French government wants to enlist the nation's psychiatrists in the war on terror, said Emmanuel Hirsch. Interior Minister Gerard Colomb was outraged at the news that a man who rammed his van into two bus shelters in Marseille last month, killing one person, had just been released from a psychiatric hospital. Now Colomb is claiming that one-third of those on France's terrorist watch list have psychological problems. And he says that doctors should identify the kinds of personalities that could potentially take extreme action. As a professor of medical ethics, let me just say that's preposterous. Certainly there is a psychological component to any person's decision to commit violence, yet there's no particular marker that when seen in a patient should send doctors running to the police. Medical practitioners already have a duty to report anyone who is an imminent danger to the public, but the vast majority of mental health patients are not a threat. And because they are vulnerable, society has an obligation to treat them with particular care. What alarms me most is that the government's attempt to turn psychiatrists into counterterrorism assets has been conducted in such a hasty, uncoordinated, and seemingly desperate manner. Is this evidence of deficiencies in our intelligence system? And finally, from China, the iPhone is a gift to autocrats. The Chinese government has long sought the means to keep closer tabs on its citizens, said Eugene Chow, and now it has the perfect tool through which to do it, the smartphone. These ubiquitous devices provide an instant window into people's browsing history, purchases, and location. Nearly 80% of all smartphone owners in China, for example, use an app called WeChat. Far more than just a messaging app, it's a hub through which people access the internet and other services. They use it to pay bills, check flights, get bank statements, and make doctor's appointments. While U.S. law restricts the government's ability to spy on citizens' browsing habits, Chinese law doesn't, and the Chinese government has made no secret of its efforts to integrate such data into its surveillance apparatus. Indeed, it's planning to create a social credit rating system that will draw on exactly such databases, logging what individuals buy and look at on the web, and noting infractions such as failing to keep up with bills or violating family planning rules. Those with low scores will have a harder time traveling and will be barred from certain privileges. The technologies that once promised freedom and openness are helping China's authoritarian rulers build a digital panopticon. And it's time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. when your new coworker is a robot. At a Wisconsin factory, managers who can't find reliable workers are staffing the assembly line with machines, said journalist Chico Harlan. The workers who remain say it isn't necessarily a bad development. The workers of the first shift had just finished their morning cigarettes and settled into place when one last car pulled into the factory parking lot. Out came two men who opened up the trunk, and then out came four cardboard boxes labeled Fragile. "We've got the robots," one of the men said. They watched as a forklift hoisted the boxes and drove into a building where old mechanical presses shook the floor. The forklift carried the boxes past workers wearing steel-toed boots and earplugs, rounded a bend, and arrived at the end of an assembly line. The line was intended for 12 workers, but two were no-shows. Another had just been jailed for drug possession and violating probation. Three other spots were empty because the company hadn't found anybody to do the work. That left six people on the line jumping from spot to spot, snapping parts into place, and building metal containers by hand. Too busy to look up. In factory after American factory, the surrender of the industrial age to the age of automation continues at a record pace. The transformation is decades long, its primary reasons well established, a search for cost-cutting and efficiency. But as one factory in Wisconsin is showing, the forces driving automation can evolve for reasons having to do with the condition of the American workforce. The robots were coming in not to replace humans, but because reliable humans had become so hard to find. It was part of a labor shortage spreading across America, one that economists said is stemming from so many things at once. A low unemployment rate, the retirement of baby boomers, a younger generation that doesn't want factory jobs, and more, a workforce in declining health. Because of alcohol, because of depression, because of a spike in the use of opioids and other drugs. In earlier decades, companies would have responded to such a shortage by either giving up on expansion hopes or boosting wages. But now they had another option. Robots had become more affordable. No longer did machines require six-figure investments. They could be purchased for $30,000. Or even leased at an hourly rate. As a result, a new generation of robots was winding up on the floors of small and medium-sized companies. And at Tenier Incorporated, where 132 jobs were unfilled on the week the robots arrived, the balance was beginning to shift. "Right here, okay?" the forklift driver yelled over the noise in the factory, placing on the ground the boxes containing the two newest employees at Tenier, Robot 1 and Robot 2. Tenier manufactures custom-made metal and plastic parts, mostly for the tech industry. 5 years earlier, a private equity firm acquired the company, expanded to Mexico, and ushered in what the company called a new era of growth. In Wisconsin, where it has 550 employees, all non-union, wages start at $10.50 per hour for the first shift and $13 per hour for overnight. Counting health insurance and retirement benefits, even the lowest paid worker was more expensive than the robots, which Tenier was leasing from a Nashville-based startup, Hirebotics, for $15 per hour. Hirebotics co-founder Matt Bush said that before coming to Tenier, he'd been all across America installing robots at factories with similar hiring problems. "Everybody is struggling to find people," he said. Inside the factory, there have been no major issues with quality control, plant managers say, only with filling its job openings. In the front office, the general manager had nudged up wages for second and third shift workers and was wondering if he'd have to do it again in the next few months. Over in HR, an administrator was saying that finding people was like trying to climb Everest. even after the company had loosened policies on hiring people with criminal records. The new hires, who were coaxed through the door, often didn't last long, with the warning signs beginning when they filed in for orientation in a second-floor office that overlooked the factory floor. "How's everybody doing?" said Matt Bader, as four new workers walked in. "All good?" "Maybe," one person said. Bader, who worked for a staffing agency, scanned the room. There was somebody in torn jeans, somebody who drove a school bus and needed summer work only, somebody without a car. Bader told them that once they started at Tenere, they had to follow a few important rules, including one saying they couldn't drink alcohol or use illegal substances at work. "Apparently we need to tell people that," Bader said, not mentioning that just a few days before he had driven two employees to a medical center for drug tests after managers suspected they'd shown up high. A worker yawned. Another asked about getting personal calls during the shift. Another raised his hand. "Yes?" Bader asked. "Do you have any coffee?" the worker said. The new robots had been made in Denmark, shipped to North Carolina, sold to engineers in Nashville, and then driven to Wisconsin. The robots had no faces, no bodies. If anything, they looked like human arms. They had been specifically designed to replicate movements with such precision that any deviation was no greater than the thickness of a human hair, a skill particularly helpful for Robot One, which had been brought in to perform one of the most repetitive jobs in the factory, making a part that Tenere refers to as the claw. The claw's purpose was to holster a disk drive. Tenere had been making them for two separate mechanical presses, where workers fed 6x7-inch pieces of flat aluminum into the machine, pressed two buttons simultaneously, and then extracted the metal, now bent at the edges. Tenere's workers were supposed to do this 1,760 times per shift. Robot One, almost programmed, started trying it out. "How fast do you want it?" Hirebotics co-founder Rob Goldiez asked a plant manager. First, the robot was cycling every 20 seconds, then every 14.9 seconds, and then every 10 seconds. An engineer toggled with the settings, and the speed bumped up again. A claw was being produced every 9.5 seconds, or 379 every hour, 3,032 every shift. Some distance away, in front of another mechanical press, was a 51-year-old man named Bobby Campbell, who had the same job as Robot One. "Beat that robot today," Campbell's supervisor said. "Ha," Campbell said, turning his back and settling in at his station, where there were 1,760 claws to make in 8 hours until he drove home. He set his canvas lunch on a container on a side table and oiled his mechanical press. He cut open a box of parts and placed the first flat piece of metal under the press. A gauge on the side of the press kept count. Wallop. One, the counter said, and after Campbell had pressed the button 117 more times, there were 7 hours to go. Unlike the employees on the assembly line, Campbell worked alone. His press was off in a corner. There was no foot traffic, nobody to talk to, nothing to look at. Campbell stopped his work and removed a container of pills. He took a low-dosage aspirin for his neck, another pill for high blood pressure. He snacked on some peppers and homemade pickles, fed 393 more parts into the machine, and then it was time for lunch. 4 hours to go. "Monday," he said with a little shrug. "I'll pick it up after I get some fuel." Campbell had been at Tenere for 3 years. He earned $13.50 an hour. He had a bad back, a shaved head, a tear duct that perpetually leaked after orbital surgery, and aging biceps that he showed off with sleeveless shirts. He liked working at Tenere, he said. Good people, good benefits. Some days he hit his targets, others he didn't, but his supervisors never got on him. He lived 31 miles and 40 minutes away, provided he didn't stop. The problem was sometimes he did. Along the drive home, there were a dozen gas stations and mini marts selling beer, and Campbell said he couldn't figure out why some days he would turn in. He hummed a song. He whistled. He fed 11 pieces of metal into the machine in a minute, and then 13, then 9. His eyes darted from left to right. He nodded his head. Campbell added a last pump of oil to the machine with 15 minutes to go. Out came a few more parts, and he fed them into the hopper, checked the gauge, and shrugged. "Not so bad," he said. "Time to go home." He had punched the buttons 1,376 times, 384 shy of his target, and now he got in the car. Annie Larson was one of the steadiest parts of an assembly line team in which so many other workers lasted weeks or months. Larson's supervisor called her old school. Others moaned about the job during lunchtime breaks. Larson, wanting no part of that, pulled up a stool to the assembly line every day and ate by herself. "If the job is that bad, go," she said. She was 48 and she had no plans to leave. Rural Wisconsin was tough, but so what? She couldn't start over. Her roots were here. Her mother lived 4 blocks away, her father 6. Her son, daughter, and grandchild were all within 15 miles. But numbers at work had been leaving her feeling more drained than usual. The team felt as if it was forever in catch-up mode. She and her co-workers were supposed to snap and rivet metal pieces, building 2,250 silver rectangular containers per week. But with so many jobs unfilled, they missed the mark by 170 the week before the robots arrived. They were off by 130 the week before. Her co-workers were always changing. Larson told them sometimes how they could be more efficient, how they could line up rivets in parallel rows, for instance. But who was paying attention? "There's no caring," Larson said. "No pride." Friday now, and Larson was tired. Mid-shift, she noticed an employee who'd missed the last few weeks with knee surgery wander over, stopping at Robot 2. "Oh," the employee said, "they're taking somebody's job." "No, they're not," Larson said. Larson was surprised that she had come to the robot's defense. But then she looked at what the robot was going to do. Put a claw in the slot, put another claw in the slot. "It's not a good job for a person to have anyway," she said. The end of the shift buzzer sounded, and Larson got into her car. Then into her recliner at home, where she poured herself a drink and tried to think about how the assembly line was going to change. Maybe the robots would actually help. Maybe the numbers would get better. Maybe her next problem would be too many humans and not enough robots. "Me and Val and 12 robots," Larson said. "I would be happy with that." 8 days later, the robot's first official day of work arrived. In came the workers, some of whom took a moment to stand nearby and watch. "It's pretty amazing," one said. "Gosh, it doesn't take breaks," said another. In one corner, Robot 1 was pounding out claws, laying them on a conveyor belt. Along a half-empty row of workstations, 6 people were constructing containers. At the end of that row, Robot 2 was filling those containers with claws. Within an hour, the workers had filled a box with finished containers, the first batch made by both humans and robots. A manager, Ed Morin, grabbed the robotics engineers and asked them to follow. He took them into another building, stopping at 2 workstations, a press brake job, an assembly job. "Can we do these?" Morin asked. The engineers studied the work areas, took some measurements, and 2 days later offered to air one version of a solution for a company trying to fill 132 openings. In September, the engineers would be coming back, arriving this time with Robot 3 and Robot 4. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. We'll be right back. Here's a couple of short health articles for you. The first, more fat, fewer carbs. One of the largest studies into how diet affects health and mortality has found that eating high quantities of carbohydrates increases risk of premature death more than excessive fat intake. Researchers led by a team at McMaster University in Canada studied health data from 135,000 people in 18 different countries across five continents. They also analyzed the participants' diet, socioeconomic status, lifestyle, weight, and other variables. Over the seven-year study period, the people who ate the most carbohydrates, deriving 77% of their total daily calories from foods like bread and rice, had a nearly 30% higher risk of early death than those who ate less. People who took about 35% of their daily calories from fat, meanwhile, had a 23% lower risk of dying early. We are hoping that dietary guidelines are reconsidered in light of the new findings, study author Masheed Degan tells Reuters.com. What we are suggesting is moderation as opposed to very low and very high intakes of fats and carbohydrates. Preservatives linked to obesity. Chemicals commonly added to processed foods and some everyday products could disrupt human hormones and lead to weight gain. Scientists at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles used human stem cells to grow hormone-producing brain tissues involved in appetite and metabolism, and cells that form the lining of the gut. Then they exposed these cells to three widely used chemicals known as endocrine disruptors. The food preservative butylhydroxytolone, perfluorooctanoic acid, a polymer in household products, including cookware and carpets, and the paint compound tributylin. They found that each of these chemicals damaged the hormones that send signals between the gut and brain to help people realize when they are full. If this communication system fails, people can overeat and gain weight, reports ScienceDaily.com. Clyde Svensson of Cedars-Sinai says the findings substantially improve our understanding of how endocrine disruptors may damage human hormonal systems and contribute to the obesity epidemic in the U.S. And we'll move right over to the Talking Points page. Russia investigation. Mueller's mafia strategy. Remember Russia? Said Michael Dobie in Newsday.com. While Hurricane Harvey and North Korea have grabbed the headlines, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into potential collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia has been creeping closer to the White House. First, we discovered Trump had pursued a Trump Tower project in Moscow during the presidential campaign, at a time when he was insisting via Twitter that he had no deals, no loans, no nothing with Russia. Then it was reported that Mueller had obtained Trump's first letter explaining why he was firing FBI Director James Comey, a letter so angry that White House officials persuaded Trump not to send it. That letter may become part of an obstruction of justice case against Trump. Finally, we learned Mueller has teamed up with the IRS and New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman to investigate millions of unreported Russia-connected dollars paid to Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. What this all means remains uncertain, but it's clear that Mueller is connecting the dots. The Mueller-Schneiderman alliance should terrify Trump, said Abigail Tracy in VanityFair.com. Mueller is following the classic anti-mafia prosecution playbook, targeting Trump associates for low-level crimes to try to flip them against their boss. When Trump recently pardoned former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, it was widely seen as a wink to Manafort and other associates to stay strong and that he has their back. Mueller, however, has a secret weapon. The president's pardon power doesn't extend to state crimes. Thus, if New York's attorney general brings state law charges against Manafort, or whichever crony du jour is looking guiltiest, said Jay Willis in GQ.com. The only thing Trump can do about it is tweet. The mainstream media is convinced of Trump's Russia guilt, said Ed Rogers in the Washington Post. The one thing that's missing? Evidence. Some of his aides might be prosecuted for offenses unrelated to the campaign, but in the end, Mueller will find nothing on the president himself. Trump's hardcore loyalist may be in denial, said Eliza Newland Carney in AmericanProspect.org. But a recent CBS poll found that 40% of Republicans now believe Trump's campaign had improper contact with the Russian government. And 75% say Trump should not try to stop Mueller's investigation. When there's this much smoke, people want to know if there was a fire. And a couple short notes. Let's see. North Korea is the only country to perform a nuclear test in the 21st century, detonating six such devices in the past 11 years. The U.S. has carried out 1,032 nuclear tests in its history, including 96 in the single year of 1962, but hasn't tested a device since 1992. The NFL's J.J. Watt, a defensive end for the Houston Texans, has led the way on celebrity fundraising for Hurricane Harvey relief effort, setting up a fundraising campaign that has collected at least $18 million. Watt pledged $100,000 of his own money and set an initial goal of $200,000. Sandra Bullock and Ellen DeGeneres each donated $1 million. And we'll finish with a quote today from Bruce Lee, quoted in PressReader.com. He says, "The successful warrior is the average man with laser-like focus." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.